Chapter 21. I woke up at 9:30 and for a moment panicked that I was late for work. Then I remembered that since I was shot at twice last night, I was told to take the day off, unless I wanted to talk to the mental health staff. I preferred the day off. I skimmed through some email, waiting to see if my brain would be willing to collapse back into sleep. No luck. Awake it was then. I got into my threep in the apartment and looked around. Van wasn't on the couch. I assumed that she had headed back to her place. Then I heard her voice downstairs. She was in the family room with Taylor and the twins watching the monitor. On the screen, there was a riot. It was happening on the mall. "What the hell happened?" I asked, looking at the monitor. Van looked over, cradling a cup of coffee. "You're up." I gestured at the monitor. Maybe I should have stayed asleep. "Then when you woke up, it would have been worse," she said. "Someone firebombed a tour group of Haydens," Taylor said. "Seriously," I said. Taylor nodded. "The Haydens were grouped up, ready to go to the Lincoln Memorial, and then some assholes drove by and chucked a Molotov cocktail at them, which is less effective on threeps than on human bodies," I said. "The assholes found that out when the threeps took off after them," Van pointed at the monitor. "Look, they're showing the video again." The video was from the point of view of a tourist phone. In the foreground, a little kid was whining to her parents about something. In the background, a car swerved toward a group of tightly packed Haydens. A young dude popped up out of a sunroof, lit a Molotov, and flung it at the Haydens. The tourist now turned his full attention to the flames. Several Haydens were on fire, flapping and rolling to put themselves out. The rest of the Haydens started running toward the car. Whoever was driving, it was obviously on manual control, panicked, took off with his friend still half out of the sunroof, and rear-ended the car in front of him. The Haydens reached the car, pulled the young man out of the sunroof, and yanked the driver out of the car. Then the beatdown truly began. By this time, one of the threeps hit by the cocktail had made it over to the car. It began kicking the bomb thrower, legs still aflame. "It would be funny if the entire mall in Capitol Hill area weren't now on lockdown," Van said. "You can't say the dudes didn't deserve it," I said. "No, they deserved it all right," Van said. "It's still a pain in the ass for everybody else." "Do we need to go in?" "No," Van said. "In fact, I just got a phone call telling me that you and I are on medical leave until Monday. We're supposed to let Jenkins and Z follow up on all our stuff." "Who are Jenkins and Z?" I asked. "You haven't met them yet," Van said. "The goddamn idiots." She pointed to the screen. "The good news is they'll handle this and all the other penny-any crap we had to deal with this week, so we can focus on the important stuff." "So we're not doing medical leave at all," I said. "You can," Van said. "Personally, I'm kind of pissed off about being shot. I want to take the people who made it happen and screw them right into the wall." "And while you were sleeping, Shane, the other shoe dropped." "What do you mean?" I asked. Van turned to Taylor and the twins. "May I?" she asked, and reached up to signal the monitor to switch stories. She flipped through several until she pulled one up full screen. The image with the story was of the Accelerant logo.
"It's that asshole Hubbard," she said. "He's buying the Agora from the government. The servers, the building, and everything else. He's taking Hayden space private."
I was about to respond when a call window opened up in my field of view. It was Tony. I connected. "Where are you?" I asked. "I'm at the FBI building," Tony said. "Where are you?" "I'm at home," I said. "Medical leave." "Fine," Tony said. "I'm coming to you then." "What's up?" "I'd actually prefer to speak to you about it someplace private," Tony said. "How private?" "However private we can make it." "What is it?" I asked. "You were right," Tony said, "about me being wrong. But it's a lot worse than that. A lot worse." "Glasses on," I told Van. She put on her monitor glasses. "Hit me," she said. I pinged her and led her into my liminal space. Then I entered it myself. There was a threep standing on my platform. It was Van. She held her hands out, looking at her representation. "So this is what it's like," she said. Then she looked over to me. "And that's what you look like." "Surprised?" I asked. "I hadn't actually thought of you having a face before, so no, not exactly," she said. I smiled at this and realized that it was the first time that Van had ever seen me smile. She looked around. "It's the goddamn Bat Cave," she said. I laughed. "What?" she said. "You reminded me of someone just there," I said. "Hold on, I need to bring Tony in." I pinged Tony a door. He stepped through and looked around. "Spacious," he said, finally. "Thank you." "Kind of looks like the bat. Tell us the bad news," I prompted. "Right." A neural network popped up above us. "This is Brenda Reese's neural network," he said. "It's a look-turn model, the Ovid 6.4 specifically. It was a fairly common model from 8 years ago, and it's running, well, was running, the most up-to-date software for its model. I've done patches for this network a few times, so I'm pretty familiar with its design and capabilities." Tony pointed to Van. "You asked me if I thought it would be possible to lock in an integrator with a commercially available network." "You said no," Van said. "I said I didn't think so," Tony said. "I didn't think so because the code that allowed it to happen in Sonny's brain was optimized for a network that was itself optimized for locking in integrators while giving the client control. Purpose-built software for purpose-built hardware." "But you were wrong," I said. "I was wrong," Tony said. "Why were you wrong?" "Because I was thinking about Johnny Sonny's network incorrectly," Tony said. "I told you that it wasn't a prototype, that it was a release-level brain. Well, it is, but it's also a proof of concept. The concept being that if you knew the hardware and the software really well, you could have the client take total control of the integrator's body. It's not something anyone tried to do, well, that we know about. There's probably some asshole NSA initiative to do just that." "Focus," Van said. "Sorry," Tony said. "Sonny showed that it could be done. Now, all anyone needed to do was translate that proof of concept into existing general networks. And to do that, you would have to do a couple of things. One, you'd have a deep understanding of the networks you were using. You'd have to know the hardware really well. Two, you'd have to be a complete fucking wizard at programming." "Hubbard," I said. Tony touched his finger to his nose. "Luckturn is the second largest manufacturer of Hayden neural networks after Santa Ana, and Hubbard is famously involved in the design process. The programming forums are full of horror stories about him coming in and tearing up his engineers' early designs for being inelegant." "And how is he as a programmer?" Van asked. "It's how he got into the field," Tony said. "He founded Hubbard Systems to manage corporate legacy computer systems, and then after he got Hayden's, he started focusing on programming for Threeps and networks that were orphaned when their manufacturers got out of the field. He did a lot of that programming himself back in the day. The programming system networks use is called Chomsky. Hubbard didn't invent it, but he did write most of the 2.0 version, and he's on the board of the Hayden Consortium, which approves new versions of the code." "The Hayden Consortium," I said. "What about it?" Tony said. "Hold on," I said. I fished through my email and pulled one up for Tony and Van to look at. "LA finally got back to me about the Ninja Threep," I said. "Ninja Threep?" Tony looked puzzled. "I'll explain later," I said. "The point is, the Threep's design wasn't a commercial design. It was a low-fee license version that the Hayden Consortium offers potential manufacturers in developing countries for use in their countries. You can't buy them or sell them in North America, Europe, or developed Asia." "So you were attacked by an imported Threep," Van said. "It could be made here as a one-off," I said. "All you'd need was an industrial 3D printer and an assembly robot." "Who has a setup that could handle that?" Van asked. "Pretty much any design shop or manufacturer who does full-scale modeling," I said. "LA said they would look into it, but it would take some time. My point here is that Hubbard's involved with both Chomsky and the Threep design that went ninja on me, which could be coincidental," Van said. I opened my mouth to respond, but Tony butted in. "Hold that thought," he said. "I'm going to tell you why Hubbard's your guy, but I have a couple more things to walk you through." "All right," Van said. "Take us to the next thing." Tony turned to me. "You remember me telling you that early on, the network manufacturers had problems with people hacking into the networks?" I nodded. "So they made it harder to do. One, they made the network architecture more complex, so it was more difficult to program for and to casually hack. but that's a very low-level measure. Ambitious hackers tend to be top-flight programmers, so another way it's done is that all software updates and patches have to be from approved vendors, who are identified by a hash they put in the header of the patch. A patch is downloaded and the hash is checked. If the patch is verified, then it downloads and installs. If it's not, then it's purged and a report is made. And that's impossible to get around, Van said. Not impossible, Tony said, but it's difficult. In order to work, they have to be stolen, and they have to still be active. When I do white hat hacking of these systems, half my job is getting a verifiable code. That's a lot of psychological spoofing, making people think I'm their boss and need their hash, finding ways to look over their shoulder while they're writing code, shit like that. How would you do that? I asked. Lots of different ways, Tony said. One of my favorites was the time I put a basket on a remote-controlled toy quadcopter, filled the basket with candy, and then flew the candy into the programmer wing of Santa Ana's headquarters. The quadcopter went from pod to pod, and while the programmers were grabbing at candy, I was grabbing shots of their work screens. I got 8 programmer hashes that day. Nice, I said. Everyone likes candy, Tony said. So someone could steal a hash and get into someone else's network, Van said, dragging us back on point. Right, Tony said. The problem for the hacker is that even when they've got the hash, they're still coming through the front door. Everyone's looking for the stolen or spoofed hash and the malicious code, which is why every patch is first unpacked and executed in a sandbox, a secure virtual machine. If something malign is in the code, it'll execute there and get caught. And there are other security measures as well. The story here is that it's very difficult to get any suspect code into the network in the established route. Even for a brilliant hacker, it's a long walk to a dry well. He turned to Van, which is why I told you that it was very unlikely. But then Reese tried to kill me, Van said. Actually, that's not the part that convinced me I was wrong, Tony said. It was the part where Chris said Reese tried to get away from the grenade after intentionally pulling it to avoid being caught. It's possible control was taken by the front door, but if it was, there'd be a record of it. Patches installed when they shouldn't have been. Sandboxes launched to test the patches. A record of the acceptance of the validation of the patch and the hashes of the programmer and company who sent it along. There was nothing out of the ordinary. So there's another way in, I said. There is, Tony said. Think about it. It was Van who got it. Fucker did it when he integrated, she said. Yes, Tony said. When a client connects with the integrator, there's a handshake of information, and then a two-way data stream opens up. This aspect of the network is meant to be a totally separate process from the internal operation of the network, and it is. But the code isn't perfect. If you know where to look, you can find places to access the network software. And that's what happened. Tony zoomed into the network to focus on the nodule that included the receiver for the client data stream. He pointed to a structure. That's an interpolator, he said. If there's any short disruption of the data stream, a millisecond or less, the interpolator pulls data on either side of the gap and fills the gap with average data. But to do it, the interpolator has to access processing from the network. It's a break in the firewall. And that's what Hubbard exploited. The image changed to a schematic. Here's what I think he did, Tony said. First, he handshakes a data feed with the integrator. Then he intentionally introduces gaps into the data stream, long enough to activate the interpolator. Then he uses the interpolator's channel to the processor to feed it an executable file. It does this as long as needed in order to download the file. Then it unpacks and rewrites the network software. It's going directly into the processor, so no sandbox. It's avoiding the verification process, so no need for a hash. It's a small file, so the integrator's network doesn't have to close the session to execute it. The integrator never even knows they've been compromised. Why the hell hasn't something like this been fixed already? Van asked. I could tell she was seriously creeped out by what Tony was telling us. Well, think about it, Tony said. This is a pretty damn big bug, but it's a bug that has a very narrow pathway to it. First, someone has to know about it. Then, they have to have the technical ability to exploit it. Then they need the technical means to exploit it, by which I mean that the ability to introduce intentional disruptions into the data stream isn't something your average Hayden is going to be able to do in their own head. This needs to be a specialized instrument between the client and the integrator. And by specialized, I mean that as far as I know, it doesn't actually exist. It would have to be created. No one's patched this bug because up until now, it wasn't actually a bug. It was a benign quirk at best. Basically, you would have to be a Lucas Hubbard to exploit this. But Brenda Rees never integrated with Hubbard, I said. She integrated with Sam Schwartz. Hubbard created the process and tools, Tony said. Once they existed, they could be used by someone else. Sam Schwartz is Hubbard's lawyer, Van said. He's in the perfect position to assist him. Not a very ethical lawyer, Tony said. But yeah, there's no reason Hubbard couldn't hook Schwartz up to his machine and let him have a go at it. You seem pretty sure that it's Hubbard, I said. You seem pretty sure about it too, Chris, Tony said. I know, but what I want to know is whether you think that because I do, or whether you think it because you have another reason to. I believe it because you believe it, Tony said. I also believe it because the scope of what we're talking about here, both for this and for what happened with Johnny Sani, requires resources of either a small country or a very wealthy person. But most of all, I believe it because of the code. The code, Van said. Yes, Tony said. The schematic disappeared, replaced by lines of code. How much do you know about Chomsky? He asked. The programming language, not the man. I don't know anything about either, Van said. Chris? I got nothing, I said. Tony nodded. The programming language was called Chomsky because it was designed to talk to the deep structures in the brain. It's a deep language pun. The great thing about Chomsky as a programming language is that it's amazingly flexible. Once you know it, once you really know it, you find out there are all sorts of ways to address any problem or issue or goal. This is essential for neural networks. They have to be flexible because every brain is different. So the language you program them in has to have the same sort of flexibility. You keeping up with me so far? It's a little esoteric, I said, which is my point, Tony said. Chomsky is a language that has to be esoteric because it's interfacing directly with the brain. Now, a side effect of this is, because Chomsky allows so many different ways to tackle any one specific problem, programmers who are truly fluent in Chomsky end up developing their own voice, by which I mean they address goals and parameters in a way that's idiosyncratic to them. If you spend any real time looking at the code, eventually you can tell who wrote it. Like someone who writes novels. Yeah, precisely, Tony said. Like, one novelist puts in a lot of description while another one is all dialogue. Same thing. And like novelists, some Chomsky programmers are good, some are competent, and some suck. And if you've seen their code before, you can tell which programmer it is from the first line of code. He pointed to the code on display. This is the code in Brenda Rees's brain that's variant from the latest point release and patching for the Ovid 6.4, he said. He pulled up some more code. Here's the code of the software in Johnny Sani's head. It reads the same. Whoever wrote Sani's code wrote Rees's code. He pulled up a third column of code. This is code Hubbard wrote back in the day when he was still pushing out patches and updates at Hubbard Systems, he said. Believe me when I say that if you ran all of this through the Chomsky equivalent of a semantic and grammatical analyzer, it would light up all across the board. All of this was written by the same person. All of it was written by Lucas Hubbard. Is that something we can use in a court of law? Van asked. You'd need a lawyer to tell you that, Tony said. But if you put me on the stand, I would tell you, hell yeah, this is all the same guy. Is that enough? I asked Van. To bring him in? Van asked. I nodded. For what? For killing Brenda Rees, for one, I said. For Johnny Sani, for another. We don't think he killed Rees, Van said. We think Schwartz did. We still don't have anything court-worthy connecting him to Sani, either. Come on, Van, I said. We know this is our guy. We go in with what we have, and Hubbard's lawyers from Schwartz on down are going to blow our heads off, Van said. And I know you don't really need this job, Shane, but I kind of do. So, yes, Hubbard's our man. Let's make absolutely sure we can get him. She turned to Tony. What else you got? Two more things, Tony said. The first is about Reese's code. What about it? Van said. It doesn't bypass her long-term memory, Tony said. Either Hubbard couldn't find a way to make it work, which is possible because the neural network layout is non-trivially different, or he decided not to waste his time because... He paused. Because he didn't plan on keeping her after he or Schwartz was done using her, I said. Yeah, Tony said. And now you know why she was carrying around a grenade. So she was aware the whole time, Van said. Aware and awake and unable to stop her body from doing anything. That's right, Tony said. And no way to get the client out of her head. Fuck, Van said, and turned away for a second. Tony looked over at me, confused. Later, I mouthed. You okay? I asked Van. If we go in to wheel out Hubbard's body after all this is done, I'm going to need you to watch me very closely, Van said. Otherwise, I'm going to punt that asshole hard, right in the balls. I grinned very widely. That's a promise, I said. Van turned back to Tony. What's the second thing, she said. Once I figured out how Hubbard hacked Reese's brain, I went back into Sonny's brain to see what things I missed before because I didn't have any context, Tony said. And I got this. He scrolled very quickly through the code until he came up with a sizable chunk of it. What is it? I asked. I didn't know at first, Tony said, because it didn't make any sense. What I think is that it repurposes part of the neural network into a relay. A what? Van said. I know, right? Tony said. It's a transmitter. It transmits the integrator's data signal, but not into the network. Instead, it mimics the network. Does it have to be the integrator's data signal? Van asked. What are you... Tony stopped, apparently getting it. Oh, he said. What? I said. I was the only one in my own liminal space, entirely left out. Fucking Hubbard, Van said. We were asking why Johnny Sonny was trying to integrate with Nicholas Bell. He wasn't. He was acting as a goddamned relay station for Hubbard. I thought for a minute. Then that means when you were interrogating Bell, it was never Bell, Van said. It was Hubbard. It was always Hubbard. The bastard's been playing us right from the start. To get close to Cassandra Bell, I said. Yes, Van said. For what purpose? I asked. You've been following the news, right? Van snapped. Rumor is there's a march on Sunday. Imagine what happens to that march when Cassandra Bell is killed by her own brother, who then spouts some sort of anti-Hayden bullshit. DC is going to burn down to the ground. Right, but what point does that serve? I asked. Why start a riot? To tank the market, Tony said. We both turned to him again. I told you I follow the sector, Tony said. It's how I stay employed. The Hayden-related companies are already trying to merge or exit the sector because of Abrams Kettering. Investors are already offloading their stocks. A full-scale riot in D.C. will scare the shit out of these companies and all their investors. They'll flee the scene, and then Accelerant can pick and choose which companies to snap up and which to let die. It'll be lauded for stabilizing the sector, when what it's really doing is sniping its competitors in the head. They'll save billions on their merger with Sebring Warner alone. But what's the point? I said. Abrams Kettering is gutting all these companies' profits. There's no gravy train anymore. You said so yourself. You know who AOL are, right? Tony said. What? Van said. AOL, Tony said. Information services company around the turn of the century. Made billions connecting people online through their phones. A dial-up service. Was one of the biggest companies in the world. Then, people stopped using their phones to get online, and AOL shrank. But for years, it still made billions in profit, because even though the dial-up sector had died, there were still millions of customers who kept their dial-up service. Some were old people who didn't want to change. Some were people who kept the service as a backup. Some probably just forgot they subscribed, and when they remembered, AOL made it too hard to unsubscribe to bother. Lovely story, Van said. And, when all is said and done, there are still more Haydens in the U.S. than people who live in the state of Kentucky. On average, another 30,000 people a year contract the disease and experience lock-in. They're not going away. Even a shrunken market can make a lot of money if you milk it. And Hubbard's the one to milk it. Because he's a Hayden himself, I said. He's one of us. That's right, Tony said.
That's what swooping in and saving the Agora is about, establishing goodwill among Haydens.
Once he has that, he can roll over every other company because he's already got every single Hayden as a customer, I said.
He'll use the Agora as leverage.
Right again, Tony said. And then Accelerant will be doing two things. Using the money he's raking in from Hayden's to diversify, even now Hayden-related companies are the minority of its portfolio, and getting ready for the day the FDA says neural networks and threeps aren't just medical devices for Hayden use only, because that's the real endgame.
Hubbard's looking to the day when everyone's got a threep, everyone's on the Agora, and no one ever has to feel old again.
That's why Hubbard could spend $1 billion on something he'd never take to market, I said. And while he'll spend a bunch of money now on companies that look like sucker bets, Tony said. He's not looking at the shrinking Hayden market. He's looking at the market that's coming after that. The market he's going to make. The market he's locking in right now. You really think that's what's happening here? Van said. Let me put it this way, Agent Van, Tony said. If you two don't arrest him this weekend, on Monday, I'm going out and putting everything I own into Accelerant stock. Van stood there for a moment thinking. Then she turned to me. Options, she said. Seriously, I said, we're doing this now? It's still your first week, Van said. It's been a busy week, I said. And I want your thoughts, all right? Van said. I'm not just asking you to have a goddamn teachable moment. All of this affects you. This is about you and people like you. Tell me what you want to do, Chris. I want to go after the son of a bitch, I said. Hubbard and Schwartz both. You want to arrest them, Van said. I do, I said, but not just yet. Explain, Van said. I smiled at her instead and looked over to Tony. Hubbard's code, I said. What about it, Tony asked. Can you patch it? You mean close the hole in the interpolator? Yeah. Sure, Tony said. Now that I know it's there, closing it up's not a problem. Can you do more than that? I asked. Are you going to pay me to do more than that? I grinned. Yes, Tony, I said. There is payment involved. Then I can do whatever you need me to do, he said. Hubbard's good, but I don't suck either. What do you have planned? Van asked me. So far, we've been a step behind Hubbard on everything, I said. That's an accurate assessment, Van said. Are we going to try to get ahead of him? We don't have to get ahead of him, I said. But I want us to arrive at the same time. And how do you propose we do that? Van asked. Well, I said, as our friend Trin would say, it might require you to be a little sloppy.